About long-term research at Reynolds Creek, Idaho, lessons learned.
Okay.
Hello, my name is Mark Seifert. I work with the Ag Research Service in Boise, Idaho. My co-author in this talk is Kitty Losey. She's with the Idaho State University. We also want to acknowledge the work done by Boise State. Just a little use the mouse here. And all funded by the Critical Zone Observatory, National Science Foundation. And so my interest in giving this talk is that I've been involved with this Reynolds Creek Experimental Watershed for some time. The watershed was set up about over 50 years ago. And when I saw this session about observatories, and I thought, well, I've had some thoughts about what observatories should be and where they fit, the niche that they can fit in terms of research in general. And so I wanted to just kind of communicate some of the things that come to my mind. So here's a picture of the Reynolds Creek Experimental Watershed. Just a little background. It was set up in 1960, representative of sort of the Intermountain Western United States. It's located in southwestern Idaho, and represents mountainous terrain, 1,000-meter elevation gradient. Precip goes with that, so you have almost like 200 to 1,200 millimeters of precip, mean annual precip, snow at the top, rain at the bottom. And then over the years, we've set up a continuous monitoring of stream flow, meteorological variables, and now soil moisture. We have about 30 sites. So overall, there's about 100 data loggers collecting data right now every 15 minutes and transmitting to the headquarters in Boise every day. I came up with four traits: long-term, large-scale, multidisciplinary, and open. And the basic idea there, these four traits basically all go together in the sense that it's hard to have a large-scale area. If you don't have long-term, it's hard to do the investments involved required. And I just wanted to sort of illustrate a little bit what I mean by these and why I think they're all important. The long-term is pretty obvious. I mean, you can start to look at what's happening with climate change. It's kind of hard to figure out what would be more important than that. At Reynolds Creek, here's 40 years worth of data in air temperature and at three different elevations, 2,000 meters down to 1,200 meters. And in all cases, all elevations, there's an increase in temperature over time. So a significant increase in air temperature over time. Of course, this has been measured in a lot of places. What's nice about doing it in an observatory is that you can relate that to other things that are going on. So in this case, we have the snow line rising. So the elevation at which snow dominates has gone up over this same period of time. And then you can also look at things. I'm not going to show you all the data, but you can look at the effect on stream flow. You can look at the effect on soil moisture. So a lot of the cascading things that come from this air temperature are all, you can track all of those things if you have a sufficiently long length record. And Harry was talking about you couldn't see the trends in 7 years, which you wouldn't see those in 7 years here either. It takes a longer term. And the other thing about having long-term data is that it provides a context for a whole bunch of other studies. So a few years ago, we did some research with the University of Texas looking at bed load transport. And so they were interested in looking at what it takes and what the flow regime is that moves particles down the stream. They put all kinds of different kinds of rocks in the stream with RFI sensors and motion detectors. And then they also put a bunch of these colored rocks out. We called them the Easter eggs. And then wanted to see how it moved down the stream. Well, when you're doing that, it's very, very useful to have some place where you're actually measuring the stream flow. So here they were putting these things up just above this weir. So we know the stream flow is happening, and of course precipitation and all that stuff upstream from there. And then it's also nice to have a record. So you can look at this is the stream flow record from that weir that's in the picture there since 1965. And then you can look and see on the record there which year they were actually doing the research, and they can see what the flow regime was there, and they can relate the flow regime to the other years and really start to get an idea of what bedload transport is like in a watershed rather than just happen to look at that one particular year. The other thing I said large scale. I probably might not be the best terminology. Landscape scale. The intent here is, I also call the intermediate scale. The idea being that you're not just looking at isolated plots, which we learn a lot from those. But for these observatories, you're not just looking at isolated plots, but you're looking at what's happening in a landscape. Smaller than than the regional modeling and stuff we see for climate models, but looking at the integrated landscape. So in the case of Reynolds Creek, we have an elevation gradient of 1,000 meters. You have in the low elevations a lot of bare ground. It's basically a desert. And then as you go transition up to the higher elevations, no bare ground. See patches of forest, much greener. And so there's associated processes that go with that. One of them is the plant available soil water. So if you look at the soil water content across these sites, we've measured for about 25, 20, almost 30 years, plant available water on the y-axis there. So if you look at the that's a little trigger happy. I'll turn this one. So on this axis, if you look at the elevation gradient, first of all, it's the same climate everywhere, dry in the summer everywhere. So if you look at the months of August, September, for example, they're always dry everywhere. But that's where the things start to change. If you look in the low elevations, the peak on average, this solid line is the average, is about maybe 5-6 centimeters of soil water storage. And as you go up, it increases to 8, and then maybe 12, and then 15, 16 centimeters of soil water storage on average per year. And then this line indicating not only is it a greater amount of water storage, but also a shift in the climate. So the peak varies from February to May. Or similarly, another example is landscape ideas. If you look at topography effects, so if you imagine sitting on a slope, looking to the south, you're on a north facing slope, looking to the south, looking at a south facing north facing slope, and same elevation, so just exactly across, separated by maybe 150 meters, which is so. What we did is we set up these sites where we looked at the snow. Snow depth, soil water content, soil temperature, so these pairs are at identical elevations, similar elevations, over 2 years. This is snow depth there. So on the north facing slope, we have 30 to 40 centimeters of snow there. We had 30 there. We had 20 there. On the south facing slope, kind of none. So it's a huge difference in snow depth. And if you look at the soil temperature, here this peak at 20 centimeters, about 20 degrees. That one's about 20 degrees, very similar. And then in the south-facing slope, 27, 28 degrees. Basically, the mean annual soil temperature is about 5 degrees difference between those two slopes, 150 meters apart. Very predictable, but still dramatic. It's a bigger difference than when we measure at 1,000 meters in the valley and 2,000 meters in the mountaintop. So obviously 5 degrees centigrade, that's a lot, and it's so almost any process that's going to be affected by temperature this is going to be important for, and I can't really think of very many processes that aren't affected by temperature. So then I didn't put this up to scare you, but just to say that the idea of the multidisciplinary, I think that's extremely important because nature is multidisciplinary, and it takes a bunch of different people from different points of view to really get at the issues that we're interested in the critical zone. So this is We recently got a Critical Zone Observatory award, and these are some of the characters involved, all of them from different points of view, all of them with different backgrounds. And there's a whole bunch of different stories I could tell you. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about how adding different expertise can really, I think, lead to these observatories being kind of transformational. So here's some a study we did up in one of the sub-watersheds called Reynolds Mountain. We've worked a lot on modeling that stuff. So my colleague Danny Marks, he can model the distribution of snow, accumulation of snow water, when it lands, when it melts, where it blows around to. So if you look in this one small area, you can see that we've got 300 meters difference there, distance. Big accumulations of snow and drifts, so you have over 1,000 millimeters of water accumulated in drifts, very much less than 100 meters away. So there's a huge variation in the snow and the water inputs due to the movement of snow. At the same time, so then I came along and said, okay, well, let's look at what's going through the soil, because we know it overwhelms what the water holding capacity is. And so we could calculate, knowing the snow depth, we will go through all this stuff. We do a lot of verification. We measure lots of soil water and lots of snow depth. And we can calculate what we think is passing through the soil profile over the year. And then we can go through and we say, okay, look at the different dates. What's the status of the soil water? And we model that. And in this case, there's this sort of a metric of blue for above field capacity, red for below, just to sort of indicate where the recharge is happening and when. And then we can calculate how much water is flowing through the profile and ended up in stream flow. And we look at that, and it's kind of small here, maybe so you don't see all the differences. But basically, we find, we're getting a pretty good idea. And so we shake each other's hand, and we say, boy, we're pretty good. And then you realize that all the water movement on here is happening subsurface. It's all in a black box, and we just kind of mush over it and said, hey, it's in the stream now. Aren't we clever? Okay, so what's really, having this critical zone observatory, one of the big pluses is we start working with people of different instrumentation and backgrounds. 2 minutes. I'll just speed up a little bit. And so this same place, we have these transects where we have seismic velocity, electroresistivity. We can look at how they correlate, and then we can start looking at actually what the flow paths are, and we're in the process of putting together a 3D map of this so we can actually say where the flow paths are and have some idea, because if you want to do the chemistry, for example, you got to know where it's flowing through. The other thing, I mean, that's the tip of the iceberg, really, because although water affects everything in terms of the carbon balance, etc., those all things all affect the water balance. So now we're measuring eddy covariance, carbon and water balance in the sagebrush. We're measuring it in aspen groves. We're looking at carbon dynamics in conifer groves. We're making more difficult measurements. We're looking at the dynamics of litter in the sagebrush. We're looking at transport of water through the plants, through the sap flux. We're looking at the plant growth. We're looking at carbon respiration out of the soil. Transport of water, transport of chemicals through the streams flow. Of course, most importantly of all, we're looking at soil carbon and distribution across the landscape, and how, as a stamp of all these processes, what we have actually in the soil, and even looking at inorganic carbon deposition and where that's happening, which I find really interesting. Last point is when I talked about open. Of course, it's data sharing we've heard a lot about, and sharing facilities and all. I think that's really critical. I just want to add one other thing to that, is this spatial data. I think this is absolutely essential. One form of that is remote sensing. We're doing a lot of work with that in terms of LIDAR and hyperspectral. So we're actually mapping out the biomass and surface cover with LIDAR in addition to the ground surface. But the other thing is the surfaces of for modeling. We're taking data that we collected at different points in the watershed from these little point measurements and putting together data sets for modeling data sets, forcing data sets, where in this case we're looking at January precip. January, we're doing precipitation, phase, amount, temperature, relative humidity, radiation, 10-meter grids across the watershed on an hourly basis for to provide a data set for doing simulation, which is the way that I think we're going to extend whatever we learn in terms of these really neat field projects. If we want this to go out into the larger scale, we got to do this kind of modeling. And I gather my time's up. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. So actually, it's Sascha Reed in this room, because we will have a gap, and so you can ask your questions in a few minutes later, so then we will have more time for discussions, okay? So I suggest that we move on to the next speaker, but thank you again.
And